Fancy a game?
Technically correct.
Forget all that formal crap about coming at me one at a time. I'll take all you bitches on!
With Tyler Bischoff.
His math's way off.
On ESPN Las Vegas.
The next two words out of your mouth aren't see it, then the third word will be, oh my God, my crotch, you punched me in the crotch.
Hello, James Neal. Start off with the Golden Knights. They lost last night to the Bruins, but we are going to start off the ice because Brad Marchand is bringing the heat on Golden Knights fans. A tweet from Joe Haggerty. Brad Marchand, when asked about the crowd noise in Vegas on Nesson just prior to puck drop versus the Golden Knights, said, "They just have louder speakers than everybody else. That is all."
Yeah, take that. Our speakers are loud.
That is a terrific accusation, by the way. That is wonderful trash talk about another team's arena and fans, because the assumption there is the Golden Knights are pumping in crowd noise, which is entirely possible. I wouldn't say that's out of the realm of possibility. You can't really prove it, but I don't think it's the most ridiculous thing to think the Golden Knights might be pumping in crowd noise. But in reality, Brad Marchand does have a very good point, because a large portion of the atmosphere at T-Mobile Arena, a large portion of why Golden Knights games are so great, is because of the video board and the speakers. The video board is terrific, and the speakers are unbelievably loud.
Like, almost unnecessarily
yes,
loud.
Unbelievably loud, to the point of you're like, this is uncomfortable.
This, my chest probably shouldn't feel this way during
yes.
a hockey game.
It is the loudspeakers in the arena that make my cup of water shake in the press box. It's not the crowd noise that does that. So the speakers are unbelievably loud. I haven't been to other hockey arenas or all of them, but it's probably the loudest speakers in the league. Like, it's the newest arena, so it's probably the case. So the speakers are ridiculously loud. Brad Marchand has a very good point. They have the loudest speakers in the league, and Vegas uses them to make the atmosphere better. That's not a crowd noise pumping in accusation. That's just every time play is stopped, there's something booming over the speakers. It's extremely loud. Even if you just listen, you can hear it on TV or the radio call. Anytime there's like a power play for the Golden Knights or a penalty kill, the in-house PA announcer will say, like, it's a power play, blah, blah, blah. You can hear him almost as loud as you can hear the announcers calling the game. Like, it's ridiculous. Like, it's very loud speakers. But Golden Knights fans deserve defending from this type of accusation, because Golden Knights fans have been incredible. Like, last night, there were like 5-10% of the seats in T-Mobile Arena were empty, and I was like shocked by that. I was like, why? Why aren't there seats here? And that's sort of the bar that they've set. Is it's like, I'll see like 6 open seats and be like, huh, what's wrong with Golden Knights fans? Like, that's where they are as a fan base, because they've been incredible. And in the arena, that crowd is as pumped as you could ever hope. Like, when Golden Knights score a goal, it is truly fantastic. Those regular season crowds are up there with some of the best atmospheres of any sporting events that I've been to. Like, it's ridiculous how good regular season crowds are for Golden Knights games. And I do think it has a lot to do with the Golden Knights. They've never been bad. Like, what? Like, you haven't experienced a bad team. There's never been any reason to be really I mean, I guess the way the Sharks series ended, but there's never really been a reason to be like disappointed or mad at the Golden Knights. There's zero expectation that anything bad is going to happen. There's no gloomy attitude, which is terrific for an atmosphere. Like, you go to UNLV football and basketball games, there is usually some sort of bad attitude from the fans where they expect it to go wrong at some point. Or when things go wrong, they're like, oh, we've seen this before. With the Golden Knights, I mean, hell, the Golden Knights last night, they were down 4-2 going into the third period. It took them 11.5 minutes to get a shot on goal, down 4-2 in the third period. That's bad. Like, you're trying to come back and win the game, and you can't even get a shot on goal, let alone score to get back in the game. Like, that's bad. If that was at a UNLV type event, people would be like, oh, here we go again. This team can't do it in the third period. But it's the Golden Knights. Everybody's still like, yeah, this is great. This is exciting. So, like, Golden Knights fans do
come back,
deserve
starts now.
Defending. Oh, let me ask you this. UNLV football, they got booed at halftime against Arkansas State. What would the Golden Knights have to do to get booed at home?
Start. No, I'm kidding. although I would say start Subban and he gives up 4 goals in the first period or something like that.
That might be the most likely. I don't think that's actually going to happen. I don't think it would actually happen, but that could be the most likely. If for some reason they kept picking Subban and he kept being terrible, maybe. But like last night, you're down two. You don't have a shot 11 and a half minutes into the third period. That's kind of, I mean, it's not booable, but that's kind of getting to the point of you're like, okay, we're not really happy with what we're watching. You guys aren't really doing what you're supposed to be doing. But I can't think of an actual scenario where the Golden Knights get booed anytime soon. Like, it's going to take 5 years of them being awful.
At what point, like, what type of behavior would Marc-Andre Fleury have to, like, exhibit for the home crowd to boo him?
He would have to kill your family member.
Okay, see, I was thinking, him using his stick as a baseball bat and just wailing on a referee.
Oh, no. That would be, people would love him more.
I know. Like, at what point is it when like, the blood starts coming out and everybody's like, oh.
As long as you're not related to the referee, I think people are going to be on board with it. I think that's it. That's the only case, is if it's personally affecting you.
So he could literally probably kill someone and there would be, you know, thousands of people who said, I didn't see nothing.
Basically, that's what it would be. But the Golden Knights fan base...
We have it. We saw it on TV.
Nope, didn't happen. The Golden Knights fan base has been terrific. And, like, even if T-Mobile does pump in crowd noise, which, again, it's possible. If they do pump in crowd noise, it's still a ridiculously good crowd. It's still awesome.
Okay, but also, if they pump in crowd noise, they need to turn down the damn music because no one can hear the crowd noise.
That's a good point. With the Golden Knights last night, I am curious if the third line experiment of Paul Stasny, Brandon Perry, and Valentin Zhukov is going to come to an end. Their expected goals for percentage last night was 20%. Just remember, on goals for percentage, above 50% is good, below 50% is bad. So that means 20% of the expected goals that were going to happen on the ice were for the Golden Knights for them. 80% were for the Bruins. So for the season, they're at 44%. Comparison-wise, the glass line is at 53%, and the top line is at 74% this year. They've been excellent through three games. So the third line, maybe Zhukov, Peary, one of them is out. Nicholas Waugh comes in, or Cody Eakin's healthy for their game tomorrow. We'll see, but I wouldn't be surprised if that gets changed around. The bigger concern, though, because the way your third line looks right now is because you're not healthy, and it's probably not what it's going to look like at any other point this season. The bigger concern is the fourth line right now. Will Carrier and Ryan Reeves, their expected goals for percentage for the season is 35%. Last year, they were at 55%. The fourth line has been good in 2 years, suppressing chances. They don't create a lot, but they also give up very, very little in terms of quality chances to the opponent. And it's three games. The sample size isn't a whole lot to look into, but the fourth line in the past has at least been a time killer. Like, you're not going to lose the game when they're on the ice most of the time. You're not going to win it either, but you're not going to lose the game when you put the fourth line on the ice. But the way they're going right now, the analytics are basically telling you this line sucks. Like, you cannot play this fourth line. Things are not going to go very well. So that might be the bigger concern, because Noshik with Carrier and Reeves is, even when they're fully healthy, that's supposed to be the fourth line. Now, you might have options where Cody Glass stays good and you move Cody Eakin to the fourth line, or you bring Nick Waugh in, but that's sort of the bigger concern, is those bottom six lines have not been good. The third line, okay, you're mixing people around because of injuries. The fourth line, though, is Nick Waugh going to fix that? I don't really know. We'll see. Tay-Tay stat of the day.
I'm out here flexing and all y'all broke-ass haters. Walk up in the club, it's a Tay Money Army. $100 bills ain't no damn change. I got the keys to this car.
Tay-Tay stat of the day.
Ryan Reeves played 9 shifts last night. 9. He makes $2.775 million, and with Alex Tuck, Cody Eakin, and Nate Schmidt hurt, he was the 8th highest paid skater in the lineup last night. And he played the fewest shifts and had the lowest ice time at 7 minutes and 34 seconds. He did not play any power play time. He did not play any penalty kill time. He played exactly 1 shift in the third period. So not all of this is new information, but what last night indicates with Ryan Reeves. 1, he will not play in the third period of a game where the Golden Knights are trailing. He does not have a skill set that Gerard Gallant views as valuable when you have to score goals. 2, he will not play special teams unless it's a desperate situation. He played a little bit of power play last year, but it's got to be a desperate situation for him to be on the power play or penalty kill. And 3, he is not even asked to try and pick up the slack when teammates are injured. Cody Eakin and Alex Tucker out. Cody Glass, Brandon Peary, Valentin Zhikov, they're all trying to fill in those roles. Hell, even Paul Stastny's having to move down and play with lesser teammates. But Ryan Reeves has the same role. Same exact role he would have if Cody Eakin and Alex Tuck were on the team. And so that's a problem when he's making $2.775 million and you had to trade Nikita Gusev, Eric Halla, and Colin Miller in the offseason to get under the salary cap. It wouldn't be that big of a problem if he was like Will Carrier and was making $700,000 this year. Okay, yeah. But Ryan Reeves plays the role of somebody that's making $700,000 in a season. And he's getting paid $2.7 million in a season. He's making more money combined than Glass, Zhikov, and Peary. Like those three that are trying to fill in for the injuries, he's making more than them combined, and he's not being asked to do any of it. So if the team wasn't up against the salary cap, it wouldn't matter. If they didn't have to dump three players in the offseason because of the salary cap, it wouldn't matter. If he was making $700,000, it wouldn't be a criticism because that's exactly what you would expect the guy making $700,000 to do. But when you're had to make moves in the offseason because of the cap, and you kept a guy that's making almost $2.8 million, and that's his usage? That's really bad. Like, he's not useful at that price. Not at all. Will Carrier is useful. Same exact role. He played 10 shifts and, like, 20 seconds longer than Reeves last night, but he's making $2 million less. So Ryan Reeves is terrible value for this team. If you're not able to use him in the third period, you're not able to use him on special teams, and you're not able to use him in a different role or a more elevated role when guys get hurt, and you're paying him $2.775 million, it's terrible value.
Yeah, I got nothing on this.
All right, Golden Knights lost, which means it's time for the best part of our show, Jake Bischoff, defensive enhancement commercials.
Did you give up 4 unanswered goals again? Do you really think you can win the Stanley Cup with Nick Holden leading the team in ice time? Did you keep the wrong Russian this offseason? Then you need to try Jake Bischoff, the top defensive enhancement on the market. Jake Bischoff will balance out your pair, whether it's too old or too young. So stop making Marc-Andre Fleury look like Martin Jones and give Jake Bischoff a try. You won't need speakers to make your arena loud anymore.
Technically Correct, brought to you by Boyd Gaming. Go to BeConnectedSports.com to download the mobile sports app for quick and easy betting from your phone or tablet. You can bet before the game or while you watch with in-game wagering. It's the Be Connected Sports app from Boyd Gaming.
Stone nuevamente. Este es Shea Theodore. Un disparo. Gol!
Bueno, señores, Max Pacioretty lo intentó, era la forma y también el tiempo, faltando 5:18 para que cayera el gol, un golazo de Max Pacioretty.
Check out the podcast on lvsportsnetwork.com.
Visit the Orleans Casino Race and Sportsbook all season long. Football enthusiasts can catch this year's games with a Monday night viewing party at Bourbon Street Lounge, with giveaways throughout the game, including jerseys. Plus, you can play Las Vegas' longest-running free football contest with $30,000 in guaranteed cash prizes each week. Or place your bets from your phone or tablet with the Be Connected Sports app. Download it at BeConnectedSports.com. Boyd Gaming has you covered for football season.
Bischoff's Briefs.
Underpants. No, I don't want to go to a party in your pants.
Bischoff's Briefs.
Underpants!
Bischoff's Briefs.
Very well.
James Neal scored 4 goals last night.
4! He had 6 in 3 games this year. He had 7 all of last season. He's playing with Connor McDavid now, so that helps. So he'll keep scoring. But James Neal has 6. Eric Halla has 3. Nikita Gusev has 1. David Perron has 1. I believe those are all the former Golden Knights with goals in the NHL. At least former Golden Knights that played for the Golden Knights. Like Mark Mathot doesn't count. Got him in the expansion draft and traded him right away. I don't think there's too much blame for Neal and Perron, even if they have great seasons, because they were older. You're 2 years removed from having them. But the Halla and Gusev ones are the ones that hurt, especially when you chose 9-shift Ryan Reeves over those two. But by the way, James Neal and the Oilers. James Neal leading the Oilers this year. They're first in the Pacific right now. They're tied with Anaheim for first. They're both 3-0-0. Vegas is already looking up at Edmonton and Anaheim, which is kind of hilarious. I kind of hope. We've talked so much about the Pacific Division being bad and how it's like the Golden Knights and Calgary and San Jose, maybe. I really hope one of these crappy teams is awesome. That'd be great. Like if just Anaheim just like, ah, we're going to win the division this year. Actually, I hope Edmonton is good because they have the best player in the NHL and they can barely make the playoffs. Well, they didn't make it last year, but that's who I hope is good.
Oscar Lindberg currently has 3.
In the NHL?
No, sorry, just goals.
Okay.
Just you know, for Zug EV.
Actually, I think he technically has more than 3 because they play in like a regular season and like a Champions League style.
Oh.
So I think he has more than 3 because I think he has 1 or 2 in that Champions League tournament too.
We should do that.
It'd be great.
James Neal score. Oh. Mbaki. Mbaki Jong is the best defensive player TJ Otzelberger has ever coached.
So Otzelberger told Mike Grimala, I've never had the pleasure of coaching a guy with his elite defensive prowess.
Does that mean height?
Probably. Forget about the defense, though. Forget about defense. I can't express how excited I am about the way UNLV players talk about UNLV's offense. This is a story in The Sun. Mbaki Jong said, every time in practice, Otzelberger emphasizes spacing. You can't do what he needs the team to be doing if there's a crowded defense or if the offense is not spaced. It's not just about scoring. It's about getting your teammates open. And maybe I'm so used to the Marvin Menzies era where that type of thinking was like never said or mentioned to us whatsoever. But like just the idea of, hey, he emphasizes spacing and we're not going to be able to score if the defense is crowded in the paint. Like just that comprehension is incredible. Like it's so wonderful because A, there's 2 reasons. One, that's how you're supposed to play. Did I just say A, there's 2 reasons? One, I think that's what came out of my mouth. One... That's how you're supposed to play.
You were on a roll. I was just letting you go.
That's how you're supposed to play basketball now. Spacing and shooting to get threes and layups. That's math. Like, that's how that's supposed to work. But number 2, the main key of Otzelberger's coaching is that spacing, spacing, spacing. And we've already heard it. Amori Hardy said something similar a while ago. Like, we've already hearing it from players. Hey, this is what he wants us to do. This is what we're supposed to be doing. We can't score very well if we don't do these things to get good spacing. So, like, I don't know. It's just excellent. I don't know. Now, how well they actually executed is another question, because you can have good spacing, you can have good schemes and principles, but if you can't hit any threes, nobody's going to guard you out there, so it'd still be a crowded defense. So actually executing it is another step, where you've got to have guys that actually make threes, and that's still a little bit of a question for this year's team, is how many good shooters will they have, but just the general idea of the players are already grasping, oh, we want to space the floor? That... It's easier to score when there's no defenders in the lane? Like, that's just terrific.
I read a pretty interesting article right before we came on air by the show's producer, Mike Grimala, about how he's been having them focus on defense. And apparently they played 98-point-something% man-to-man. And I'm like, oh, cool, we're not going to play zone. Is this team defensively capable of not having to fall into a zone?
Probably not.
Okay. So, going to have to beat them 150 to 149. Rob Manfred says there is no plan to move the A's to Las Vegas.
Obviously, right? Like, obviously they don't have a plan in place to move them. But the RJ talked to Manfred, who basically said they're not moving the A's to Las Vegas, but if the A's can't get a new ballpark, all options would be considered. The part about this I love is the way the city of Oakland has made Rob Manfred look to be an ass. Like, they've painted him as, hey, he threatened to move the team out of Oakland just like the Raiders if we don't give them what he wants. It's a terrific job by the city of Oakland.
Well, I mean, I thought everyone was sort of in agreement that Rob Manfred's kind of an ass. Did you not hear how he handled the whole...
Don't care.
Project Wolverine?
Don't care. Manfred went in for a, like...
Google it.
jab into the wound of Oakland of losing the Raiders and was like trying to use that as a threat. And the city of Oakland, and granted, they look like they might end up backing down anyways, but the city of Oakland was like, yeah, we'll just tell everybody what you said and make you look like an idiot. Now you got to go talk to somebody from the Review Journal to try to clarify your statements. So I don't really know how this works out for the A's in Oakland, but I just enjoy them making him look like a bully. Like, give us what we want, or we'll do what the Raiders did and leave the city. And again, it all feels like a leverage play.
I kind of hope the city of Oakland just goes, bye, figure it out then.
I do think the way the A's end up moving out, and the Diamondbacks too, is stadium. Like, the Major League Baseball doesn't want to leave. They don't want the A's to leave the Bay Area. Like, they see value in that. But it'll be the same situation with the Raiders. If they can't, for whatever reason, get a new stadium in Oakland, they'll leave. They will leave for a city like Las Vegas or Las Vegas itself. If City Henderson's like, here's a bunch of money, come build a stadium here, they'll leave if they can't get it done in Oakland.
Can't we get, like, the Kings? Can't we get, like, an NBA team? We have raised $500 for the Lights FC Llama Pooper Scooper.
We are at $512, which means we have eclipsed our goal of $500. We are still raising money, though. You can make a donation because Lights FC have agreed all of this money that we have raised for the Pooper Scooper is going to go into the Robert Smith GoFundMe account. If you're unaware, Robert Smith, who used to play UNLV, is the color analyst on our broadcast here for UNLV basketball. Had a stroke. Is he still in the hospital? I believe he's still in the hospital. I haven't actually seen an update if he is or is not. But they have a GoFundMe set up to help pay for his medical bills. So we are going to take all of this money for the Pooper Scooper, put it into Robert Smith's GoFundMe account, and instead of Brett Lashbrook stealing it from me. That's the plan. By the way, one point on Lights FC. We'll talk about this more throughout the week. But they have their biggest game in franchise history on Saturday. A, they're playing Reno. In-state rival. They lost to them 4-0 earlier in the year, so if they're going to win the Silver State Cup, they're going to have to beat them by 5 goals. They could beat them by 4 goals and then beat them on the tiebreaker that is the disciplinary point system. But they'll probably
Wait,
not.
Are you serious? They'll this probably, team might,
it's possible.
It might come down to red card.
If Lights FC win by 4 exactly and Reno gets a red card, it's possible. It's possible. Other than
just
that, they've got to win by 5.
Winaldo's just like, okay, everyone, we're going all attackers, and I need you guys to be mouthy AF.
Yes, exactly. The other reason this is a big game, or the biggest game in franchise history, is Lights FC. They're still in the playoff hunt, and they pretty much need to win. If they lose, they could be eliminated if New Mexico and LA Galaxy both win on Saturday as well. A win and a New Mexico draw or loss and a San Antonio draw or loss, and Lights FC would actually control their own destiny for the final playoff spot. So, decent situation for Lights if they win and they can get a little bit more help going into their final game of the season.
Liz Cambage was named to second team All-WNBA.
She was the only ace selected to one of the all-WNBA teams, which is, I think, another highlight of the disappointment of the season, because at the All-Star break, they had 3 of the top 10 vote-getters, so they had 3 starters in the All-Star game. They had a super team, and they didn't really perform like one, or at least the last month of the season, they didn't really perform like one. But here is my concern going forward for the Aces next year. Can Liz Cambage and Asia Wilson play better on offense together? Because post play is inefficient, mid-range jumpers are inefficient, and the Aces love those inefficient shots because they're 2 best players. That's what they're good at. Like, those are 2 guys you just throw it into the post, and they try to turn around and score, or they take a shot from 7 or 8 feet away. Like, that's what Cambage and Asia Wilson do. I'm not sure that it works at a level high enough to win a championship, but the bigger concern is you look at Cambage and Wilson. They get teamed up last year, and the thought process, at least for me, was their total numbers will fall because they're playing together now. Instead of being the dominant one on different teams, they're both together. So their total numbers will fall, but their efficiency should rise. Both players posted a lower offensive rating this past season than they did in 2018. Cambage's 2-point percentage plummeted from 59% in Dallas to 50% this year, and she shot fewer free throws, and she went 2 of 12 on threes the entire season after she took 1.4 per game in Dallas the year before. Asia Wilson shot fewer free throws, and her turnovers saw a big increase. Her field goal percentage actually went up a little bit, but her turnovers was a massive increase, and that's why her overall offensive rating fell. So those two playing together, you've got two of the best post players in the league, but that might not be a good thing. So how do you figure out how to get efficient offense out of those two is probably the key to the Aces winning a WNBA title next year, which should be the expectation given the roster that they have. Totally correct. New sponsor on board. We're brought to you by Michael E. Minden Diamond Jewelers in the Fashion Show Mall. If you aren't buying your diamonds and jewelry from Minden Jewelers, you are paying too much and getting poor quality. Always shop Michael E. Minden and get real quality for the lowest prices. Right now, you can receive two tickets to see Journey or Gwen Stefani with any purchase over $299. This is the best jeweler. Don't go anywhere else. For quality, trust, and value, join the rest of Las Vegas and let Michael E. Minden become your jeweler.
Is the girlfriend a big Gwen Stefani fan?
I've already seen that show together.
Oh. So you already got the ring.
Didn't propose there.
Get in touch with the show on Twitter at @Bischoff_Tyler. Time to get an update from the sports book with Bob Scucci.
How much? How many extra points is Gardner Minshew's mustache worth?
I'm giving it 2.5 points. I really like it, and I'm a big Minshew fan.
Brought to you by Boyd Gaming.
Bob Scucci joins us now. We'll start with the NFL, and we'll start with the Raiders. Did the Raiders upset? Was that good for you guys?
Oh, that was great for us. Late move on Chicago. We opened up that line at 4.5, and by game time it was -6. Everybody was just really enamored with Chicago beating the Vikings. So that was one of our biggest games of the day, and the fact that they won the game straight up was really great for us.
I have a question if this is anything you guys pay attention to when you make lines for London games. The Raiders showed up in London on Monday. The Bears did not get there until Friday. Is there anything you guys would adjust as far as, oh, this team showed up late to London, so they're not going to be as good when the game starts?
Typically, we'll pay attention to anything, you know, travel-related, if there was, like, big delays and they got caught on the runway for 10 hours, things like that that can kind of wear you down mentally. We didn't make any adjustments for that. We actually kind of favored the Raiders a little bit, and we weren't too surprised that everybody laid the favorite with Chicago on that one, so it just kind of worked out in our favor.
What was the Raiders' win total at the start of the season? Was 4.5?
Five and a half, depending what time of year you bet it. We fluctuate it 5 and 5.5.
Is that now that they've already got three, like, what's sort of your expectations at the sportsbook for what they do the rest of the season?
Yeah, I think it'll be pretty close. I mean, they caught Indianapolis at a real good time, I think. In retrospect, the Indianapolis win, looks like the Colts were really preparing for the Chiefs game the following week, so maybe they didn't take the Raiders as seriously as maybe they should have. So the Raiders caught the Colts at a good point. So I think we're right on pace. I still think we'll see six wins. I wouldn't be surprised if they reached seven, but I also wouldn't be surprised if they only ended up with six.
All right, still can't get optimistic. Still seven is the ceiling. That's as far as you're willing to go right
now. Well, they're banged up still. They're trying to get healthy, and there's just a lot to expect the rest of the season. But hey, you never know. I mean, we're pulling for them.
Where are the undefeated 49ers in your odds for the NFC?
Well, we still got them hovering around 20. Oh, just for the NFC?
Yeah.
Oh, I'm sorry. About 15-1 for the NFC, and they're slowly creeping up. Okay, I know they're undefeated and had some good wins, but we're still looking at some of those wins and taking them with a grain of salt, considering some of the teams that they played, you know, the Cincinnati Bengals and the Browns, and you know, so we're just not completely sold on them. They certainly are creeping up in the ratings, but I'll tell you what, the NFC looks like they're kind of pretty stacked there at the top, and it's kind of anyone's ball game. The real test will be this week. We have the Rams a 3.5-point favorite against the Niners, and I really feel like this is a good spot for the Rams. So this will be the telltale test on just how good the Niners are.
What are the Packers? Are they the favorites in the NFC right now?
We actually have the Saints, the Packers, the Eagles. They're all kind of right in that same area. The Cowboys got downgraded a little bit based on the last couple of losses, but they're still kind of right there in the mix. Like I said, they're all kind of stacked at the top of the NFC. It's funny, we have the two AFC teams, the Patriots and the Chiefs, like right there at the top, and then there's about 10 NFC teams before you get to the next best AFC team.
Wait, who is the next best AFC team? And please tell me it's the Bills.
It is. It's the Bills, but followed real closely by the Houston Texans. So I will say the Bills and the Texans, they're right there. The 3 and 4 spots for the AFC.
Wait, what are the Bills' Super Bowl odds right now?
What do we have them at? Well, they're still at about 25-1. So you could get some pretty good odds on them.
How would it affect it if they just straight up traded quarterbacks, the Texans and the Bills?
Oh, boy, I jumped the Bills way up there. I mean, the Bills are doing it with the defense, not so much with their offense. So if they get a premier quarterback, I'll put them right up to the top.
If we look at college football, okay, UNLV football, what did they closed at plus 22 against Boise State? Is that right?
Yes.
So UNLV scored a touchdown with a minute and 31 seconds left, and they cut the lead to 18. Then Boise State returned the onside kick to the 5-yard line and ran it in on the next play to win by 25 points. So was that last 2-minute beat good or bad for you guys?
Oh, that was a dagger. That was one of the late games that we needed UNLV to cover. Everybody was on Boise, so that was just like just a dagger in the side. That one hurt.
Is that is returned onside kick for a touchdown or a near touchdown? Like, that's got to be one of the leading causes of bad beats.
Yeah, that and the old pick six and an occasional intentional safety to end the game sometimes. Those ones are really hard to swallow.
What do you guys have the line for UNLV going to Vanderbilt this week?
Vandy, 15.5.
So, what's the math there on Boise State against Vanderbilt on a neutral field? Is Boise State like 10 points better than Vandy?
Yeah, that's about right. Vandy's a 1-4 team, but a 1-4 SEC team just carries a little bit more weight.
So UNLV, if we look rest of the season, they get San Jose State at home, and they go to Colorado State, two other bad Mountain West teams. Will they be favored in either of those two games or any games the rest of the season?
They should be favored a little with San Jose. At Colorado State, no. They may be favored maybe one more game.
what would have to happen in this Vanderbilt game for it to be like a pick'em against San Jose State?
UNLV would have to beat them straight up. If they can beat them straight up, I think that'll kind of increase their stock a little bit.
We have two pretty big top 15, maybe even they're both top 10 matchups, but how big of a favorite do you guys have Oklahoma against Texas?
11-point favorite is what we opened on that. We're getting a little money on Oklahoma, so that line may go up a little bit.
And what about Florida and LSU?
Yeah, that one was a great game, but LSU is a 13.5-point favorite, and with Florida playing as well as they are, we're getting a lot of takers on Florida plus the points. Maybe they're not thinking they're going to win the game straight up, but certainly with 13.5 points, they're seeing a lot of value there.
Maybe I have a bad memory and don't pay enough attention, but it feels like there's more top 25 matchups, and even in this case top 10 matchups, where there's just really large point spreads between teams that you would think, oh, they're both good.
Yeah, we've seen it all year where the top tier teams just keep pulling away from the rest of the field, and there's just this huge disparity between those handful of really good teams and then the rest of the pack. So like you said, the difference between the number 5 and number 6 teams in the country versus the number 7 and number 8 teams in the country, there's this huge disparity there worth about 7 points different between the number 6 team and the number 7 team.
So if we switch over to baseball, we have two game 5s today. So what do you guys have, and what's happening with the betting for the Dodgers and the Nationals?
Well, certainly Dodgers are getting the bulk of the action here at home, but it's not as lopsided as you would have expected with Washington, coming back and given the Dodgers run for their money. It's just slightly favoring the Dodgers. We have the Dodgers $1.65 favorite right now, but the action is just only slightly heavy on the Dodgers. And then in the St. Louis Atlanta series, just great two-way there. I think just dead 50% action on both sides. We actually have a game of pick'em -105 on both sides, so great two-way there.
How's the handle looking for those two games?
It's not bad. It's actually, you know, the Atlanta's kind of flown under the radar for a team to win their division this year. They really haven't drawn all the support that some of the other more high-profile teams are getting. So, but now that they're in the spotlight and in the playoffs, both these series are getting a lot of action. And then Houston and Tampa Bay, that game tomorrow, we have Houston a $2.50 favorite, but no one expected this series to be as close as it is.
Yeah, so if we make an assumption that the Astros beat the Rays tomorrow and they go and play the Yankees in the ALCS, do you change what your odds would have been at the start of the playoffs for an Astros-Yankees series based on this first series against the Rays?
Not too much, you know, maybe 5 cents, maybe, but we're still, there's other dynamics in play, and there's a pretty big bettor around the country that is just betting the Astros every game, so we don't want to go too low on the Astros and let everyone have a better price on them.
What I imagine might change for the Astros is maybe some of the individual games, because they used Verlander and they're going to use Cole in game 5. So I assume if they win, it'll have to be Zach Greinke that starts game 1. And not that Zach Greinke's bad, but he's not the dominant pitcher that Cole and Verlander have been this year.
Absolutely. So, you know, all of our odds are based on pitchers and how they go, you know, against the Yankees versus right-handers and versus left-handers. You know, there's different team batting averages for both pitchers. So all of that gets taken into account for sure.
What World Series matchup do you want the most?
Well, I've been saying Dodgers, Yankees, you know, that East Coast, West Coast, kind of a throwback, I think, you know, to the 1970s and 1980s. That wouldn't be a bad series. So we're kind of pulling for that one.
Is Tampa, Atlanta the worst possible outcome?
maybe Tampa, Atlanta. That'd probably be the lowest in terms of popularity.
Well, he is Bob Scucci with Boyd Gaming. Bob, as always, we appreciate the time.
Thanks for having me.
Tampa Atlanta would be funny. Tampa winning anything would be funny.
I would actually put money that Tampa Atlanta would do better ratings than Dodgers Yankees.
Based on what?
Based on last year. Based on Red Sox Dodgers basically being the lowest rated World Series in like 2 decades.
Well, they'd break that even more. Can you name more than one Tampa Bay Ray?
Is Snell still there?
Who the hell is G-Man Choi?
Is it like Players Weekend, or is that that's his name?
He's one of the few Korean baseball players, and the Tampa Bay Rays fans chant his name every time he comes up.
There are Tampa Bay Rays fans?
Yeah, no, that's the funny part about the Rays.
Is there watch parties in Montreal? Is that what's going on?
That's the funny part about the Rays, is it's all like, look at this great crowd that Tampa Bay's having, and it's like 75% full, and it's like, well, there were 75 fans total at all their home games, so it is good, but it's just funny.
I don't know. I just enjoy Atlanta.
Can you name more than two Braves?
Is Freddie Freeman on that
team?
He
is. He's awesome.
So to answer your question, no.
Oh, see, yeah, nobody's going to watch the Braves and the Tampa Bay Rays.
Nobody watched Boston.
It won't even do well in the Southeast because they'll be competing against football for half the World Series.
All right. Everyone told me it's Boston and it's the Dodgers. It's going to be the greatest thing ever. And then it was like, I don't want to watch this. Nobody wanted to watch it because it's two big city teams. And it's like, eh, I'm good.
Yeah, but you can name at least one player on each of those teams.
Yeah, David Ortiz and Jackie Robinson, right?
Nailed it.
You're listening to Technically Correct with Tyler Bischoff, brought to you by Boyd Gaming.
A very big sports story is happening.
Tyler Bischoff is...
If a very big sports story was happening, we'd know it.
We do know it. We just don't understand it.
You don't understand it.
Technically correct.
You guys aren't going to believe this, but Jared was incredibly wrong. There have been three other World Series with a lower average TV rating than last year's World Series in the last 10 years.
Oh, all right. I'm wrong.
Didn't have good ratings. Still the fourth lowest of all time, but all five of the lowest of all time have been in the last 10 years. So, TV ratings are going down regardless of who's playing. Be worse for Tampa and Atlanta. All right, yesterday...
I just want to see a World Series with an empty stadium.
Earlier this week, we talked about the Raiders and possibly making the playoffs. They're 3-2 already. You just heard Bob Scucci tell us they might only get to 7. But they have 3 wins already, and they have the Bengals, Jags, Broncos, Titans, and Jets still on the schedule.
Why is the Jags in that group?
Because they're not that good.
Their offense is incredible.
That could be another 3-4 wins for the Raiders. They also, though, have the Packers, Texans, Chiefs, Chargers twice, and Lions, teams that have capable quarterbacks to beat LaMarcus Joyner. If you get one or two of those, you might be looking at an 8 or 9 win season. A 9-7 gets you possibly in a wild card spot. But 538 only gives the Raiders a 27% chance to make the playoffs. And the main problem there is they have basically a 0% chance to win the division. There's no expectation that they'll be able to compete with the Chiefs for the division, which means they have to win one of the wild card spots. And the way it looks for the Bills right now, the Bills aren't going to beat the Patriots in their division, but the Bills are going to have like 11 wins because they already have a good record and they have an even easier schedule than the Raiders the rest of the way.
Have they played the Dolphins yet?
No, I don't think they've even played them. I think they get the Dolphins twice still and the Jets twice still.
Hey, his liver is looking better.
So the Bills are likely to be one of the wild card teams, which leaves one spot left for the Raiders to get. And you have Baltimore and Cleveland. Cleveland might not be there, so there might not be an AFC North team that's really competing for a wild card spot. But the AFC South, they're all going to be 8-8. The Jags, Texans, Colts, and who am I forgetting out of the AFC South?
Titans.
They're all going to be 8-8.
I don't know if the Titans are going to go 8-8. They might go 7-9.
They'll win 7 games, but they're all going to be right there. So that's the problem for the Raiders, is it kind of looks like there might only be one spot for them to get if they don't beat the Chiefs, and they've got like a plethora of teams that are also going to win 8 games.
Would it be the best thing ever if the Jags wind up being the team to make it out of that division with like a 7-8-1?
It'd be terrific. That's what the AFC South should be every year. When Peyton Manning's not there, that division winner needs to be under 500. Those are the rules of the NFL. The Raiders, by the way, are confusing because they're better than expected, but not really good enough to be clear playoff contenders. And so it's not a great situation because, as you keep saying, they're going to end up with pick number 13 in the NFL draft, which isn't ideal. But I guess you can't blow a top 5 pick if you don't have one. So that's a little bit of good news.
There's still value to be found in the middle of the first round.
Yeah. Colton Miller.
Have to be able to scout better than who should we take with the 4th? The run stopper!
So on the edge rushers in Cleveland Ferrell, Arden Key is going to miss some time. Ian Rappaport reported that Arden Key has a strained patellar tendon and will miss a couple of weeks. We talked earlier in the week about the Raiders' edge rushers and how they have 4 guys. They usually have 3 active spots on their game day roster. So this basically assures that we'll see Benson Mayoa, Cleveland Ferrell, and Max Crosby the rest of the way. Or not the rest of the way, but while Arden Key is out. If we look at Pro Football Focus grades on the Raiders' edge defenders, Benson Mayoa, 72.4, by far the best. Max Crosby, 59.2, slightly above average. Arden Key, 48.7. Cleveland Ferrell, 47.4. Cleveland Ferrell has the worst Pro Football Focus grade of any of the Raiders' edge rushers. Now, I say this every time we bring up Pro Football Focus grades, don't take them as like some sort of fact and that he's the worst of those 4, but if you have a bad Pro Football Focus grade, it's very doubtful that you're playing well. He might be better than a 47.4, but it's not like he's some superstar edge rusher. And so my question on Cleveland Ferrell becomes, we're not very far into his career, so it's not time to like jump ship and different schemes, or you can use him differently to help him out. But like, how good can he actually be? Like, if you're not as good as Arden Key and Max Crosby in your first year, when they're in their first or second year, how good do you really expect him to ultimately be? You use the 4th overall pick on him, so I think you'd expect him to be good. It doesn't have to be Pro Bowl level player, but you expect him to be good. But he's the worst edge rusher on the team right now.
Can't play hot as shit, bro.